You're with SBS Radio. Find more great stories in your language at sbs.com.au.
Wadamuli and welcome to NITV Radio. I'm Kerry Lee Harding, and it's that time of the week again where we get to check in with Ray Johnston, Wiradjuri woman and journalist, to talk all things science and technology. Welcome back to the program, Ray.
Oh, thanks for having me back, sis.
Good to be with you again this week, sis. Now, we've got a number of things to get through today in our science and technology segment. First cab off the rank is a story about the fact that researchers are mapping the superhighways travelled by the First Nations people across Australia. What can you tell us about this one?
Yeah, this is some really interesting research, actually. So what they're calling superhighways used by a population of up to 6.5 million Aboriginal people over time to navigate the continent tens of thousands of years ago, it's been mapped. And this is a case of, you know, modern science catching up with what we already really know from traditional Indigenous knowledge and science. And I spoke with one of the researchers on this study, and he described what they've done is collect a whole range of information from multiple different sources. To the analogy he used was to build a car, and now they're going to drive that car around the continent, confirming that information with traditional owners. So this research at the core of it is about working out how people not only survived but thrived in our harsh environments. And I think it really highlights the capabilities and resilience of our ancestors, as well as show how large and well-organized groups navigate through really tough terrain. And that terrain tens of thousands of years ago, it was really different to how it is today. So they're looking at a time when sea levels were much lower and when Australia was connected to New Guinea and Tasmania as well. And that land was known as Saul. Mm. And it was about 30% bigger than what our continent is today. And they've made this digital model that shows what would have been seen back then. And again, this is something that we know from oral histories passed down through many, many generations, as well as from underwater archaeology, which is one of my favourite kinds of archaeology. These superhighways that they've called them, they follow really well-documented Aboriginal trade routes that crisscross the country. So like the Cape York to South Australia via Birdsville trade that was used to trade the tobacco, and also the trade of the Kimberley Barley Shell into Central Australia. And there's also a lot of similarities between this map of superhighways and the most common trading and stock routes that were used by early Europeans, who, of course, followed already well-known routes established by Aboriginal people. So the researchers hope that future work from this could help to relocate and protect archaeological sites as well, because they're more common along these routes. Mm. And when I spoke to the researchers and was like, hey, have you worked with any Aboriginal communities on this research? They were saying, no, not yet, but we plan to on the next step. So while it would have been nice to start from, you know, the community level and build up this research from there, they're kind of working their way backwards in that aspect. I think they're going to discover a whole lot more than they bargained for once they do that outreach.
Sounds like it indeed, sis. And that's a very good news story today to start off with on our science and technology segment. Now we go from talking about the superhighways travelled by the First Nations people across Australia to a survey of coral restoration projects actually finds Australia has more work to do.
Yeah, this was a group of German and Australian researchers as well. And they did a big survey of all the projects that are happening around the world aimed at transplanting coral to help reefs. And they said that there was a real lack of Australian coral restoration projects, which is surprising considering we have the Great Barrier Reef. This study actually identified more than 50 new projects that weren't being talked about and most people didn't know about. And they're mostly from the Caribbean and the Indo-Pacific regions. And they found that 80% of these projects are mostly aimed at restoring local habitats. And they faced a lot of problems with sustained funding as well. They really need some cash injection into it. And they said since the Great Barrier Reef bleaching events recently, There has been an increased push in Australia for restoration efforts, but it's still not enough, especially when compared with the rest of the world. So I think this is the first time that we've really seen results globally of what's being done to protect reefs, and we can really measure ourselves against those projects all around the world, and we've got a lot of work to do. So hopefully we can get the funding locally and get that work done.
And as you mentioned there while speaking about this subject, the fact that we do have the Great Barrier Reef here and there is coral bleaching happening up on the reef, it's of quite a concern, this issue.
Yeah, it's a huge concern, and the flow-on effects to, you know, the rest of the environment and the ecology up there and around the world, really. The Great Barrier Reef has impacts globally. We would need to be doing everything that we can to protect that area realistically. And, yeah, I think the fact that we have a lack of projects going on when compared to the rest of the world is a bit concerning, to be honest, because we do hear about a lot happening on the reef, but it doesn't seem like it is a whole lot. So hopefully we can see more projects in the future.
Now we go from talking about coral restoration projects to another environment story, that New Zealand glaciers are actually thinning 7 times faster now than 20 years ago. What can you tell us about this story, Sis?
Yeah, so we've been looking at the global glacier mass and how much has been lost over the last 2 decades. And it has sped up a lot. So to look at this, researchers, they mapped over 200,000 glaciers, that's nearly all of the glaciers on Earth, to understand how glaciers melt over time. And, you know, this has impacts on water locally and also how it contributes to rising sea levels. And knowing about this can help us predict future changes so that we can plan to manage water resources and sea level rises in vulnerable areas. So it's important to know about this. And the researchers, they looked at satellite and aerial imagery to study the changes of individual glaciers. And they say that between the year 2000 and 2019, glaciers lost on average a total of 267 gigatons of mass per year, and it contributed to 21% of sea level rises. So that's a huge amount of glaciers and water being lost. And that glacier mass loss has been accelerating at 48 gigatons per year each decade since 2000, which could explain 6 to 19% of the speeding up of the sea level rise as well. So there's a huge amount of water being lost from the, or ice rather, being lost from these glaciers and turning into water. And honestly, really the only way to combat it is to deal with climate change immediately and to really have a look at what we're doing to the environment and make some really big moves to stop this. Or we're going to see some huge issues with sea level rises in the future.
Now we go from talking about New Zealand glaciers to talking about office desks. And apparently your desk location at work may actually affect your sense of focus. Do tell me more, Sis.
I've always suspected this, but it's nice to have science back you up. So if you're working in an office and it's open and plan and you've got your workmates all around you and they've got their desks all around you, yeah, there can be different spots in the office that can help you focus better than others. So staff with higher numbers of desks that they can see when they're sitting at the desks, they're less likely to say that their workplace is helping them focus, that they find it harder to focus because of distractions and difficulty talking to co-workers without disturbing other people. Staff whose desks are faced away from the main area of the room with lots of co-workers behind them also say that they focus a lot because they don't have a lot of control over their environment. They're usually, you know, facing a wall. But workers who face the room and don't have a whole lot of desks in front of them, they can't see heaps of people, they say that they're more focused and productive and their teams work better together. but workers at windows, if you've got a window desk, you're going to be so much more productive and you're going to be so much more focused than anyone sitting beside walls. So if you've got control over your environment in your workplace, you're 40 times more likely to be more productive and to focus better and to have better teamwork. So I reckon we should all be lobbying our bosses to say, let us pick where we sit because we're going to be better at work.
I'm so happy to hear that. I have a window desk that does look out and face the rest of the office as well. So I think what I've heard is really positive from you today, sis. Thank you.
Yeah, you've got the best desk in the office by the sounds of it.
It does sound like that, doesn't it? And that brings us to the end of our science and technology segment for this week. It's been an absolute pleasure. Rae Johnston, Wiradjuri woman and journalist. Thanks so much for coming on and talking all things science and technology, as you do each week, sis. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, sis. Till next time.
Want to hear more stories like this? Listen on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from.